Good evening, everyone. We'll start tonight by setting our motivation. I thought it would be very helpful to do a glance meditation on the 10 fortunes. And then when we get to the 10th one, I'm going to embellish it a bit. I've added some things that aren't in the formal list of 10, but I don't think you'll have any argument with what I've added. So the first fortune is the fortune of being a human with human intellect and potential. Then there's the fortune of being in a country where Dharma exists, allowing us to encounter spiritual teachers, teachings, and communities of practitioners. And there's the fortune of having good mental and physical faculties. Next fortune is not having committed a heavy negative action, like killing one's mother, killing one's father, killing a foe destroyer who has attained nirvana, causing a schism in the Sangha, or purposely causing a Buddha to bleed. Fifth fortune is having faith and conviction in the teachings of the Buddha. So even if we had all the other fortunes, without this one, of having faith and conviction in the teachings of the Buddha, we would not engage in Dharma at all. Sixth fortune is being alive during an age when the Buddha has come. The seventh fortune is that not only has the Buddha appeared, but has taught an entire system of practice. The eighth fortune is that the teachings still remain and have not disappeared. The ninth fortune is that we have begun to put the teachings into practice, or at least we have begun to think about them. And the tenth fortune is that of having all the conditions that we need for Dharma practice. We have enough food, we have clothing, we have shelter. We have qualified teachers to guide us. And what I've added in now is that we're living in a time when His Holiness the Dalai Lama is teaching. And there are translators to make these teachings available in multiple languages. The internet is allowing for people who don't live close to a center or a monastic community to have access to the teachings. And the books written on Buddhism by authentic spiritual teachers are growing daily. So I see this as a very special lifetime. And it's special because the timing of when we were born has allowed for us to hear and see His Holiness the Dalai Lama teach. Prior to 1959, the only people who had access to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all the previous Dalai Lamas were people living in Tibet, a few Chinese people, some Mongolians, and people in neighboring countries to Tibet, and a very few foreigners. So we've been able to witness the profound flourishing of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings. And we've been observing how he lives his three commitments in every moment, which are to protect common human values, tolerance and compassion, as a religious practitioner to promote world religious harmony, Buddhist self-discipline, and as a Tibetan to represent his people until oppression by China is solved. And so as we reflect on these ten fortunes, we may not have all of them all the time, but we have many of them, and this can really make our mind joyful. And it can also inspire us to do what it takes to continue to learn in the path and be very open, especially when circumstances become very challenging. And to do this so that we can keep the long-term goal clearly in mind of becoming a fully awakened being so that we can truly benefit all sentient beings. Venerable Chödrön is still away. She's in Singapore right now, and we received a short video from one of her students, and it showed Venerable Chuni and Venerable Chödrön circumambulating a stupa in Borobudur. So that was very, very inspiring. So Venerable Chödrön will be back at the end of this month. We're going to continue with the quiz on the grounds and paths. And last week, Venerable Tarpa did questions 3 and 4. Today we're going to do questions 5 and 6. So since Venerable Tarpa very kindly explained most of question 5, we're going to make the first part of this talk an interactive talk. So you've heard the answers last week. And then question 6, I'll go through what I've discovered. And then if people have things that I've missed or that are slightly incorrect, you can add those things in. So question 5 has a number of parts to it. So we'll do it one part at a time. And the first part asks us, what is the demarcation of entering the Mahayana path of accumulation? And call out your answers.
Spontaneous bodhicitta.
Right. And as Venerable Chödrön explained, this is generating bodhicitta in an unfabricated manner. And this means when we have that, this unfabricated manner, we'll see any sentient being and automatically the wish will come to be able to liberate them and to attain enlightenment in order to do so. And she went on to explain that right now for people who are ordinary beings, I'm an ordinary being, right now the bodhicitta is fabricated, which means we deliberately set it at the beginning of teachings. So a person on the path of accumulation is a Mahayana clear realizer of the doctrine. The word Mahayana is used to differentiate from the fundamental vehicle. So this is someone who has realized bodhicitta. Clear realizer of the doctrine means that there is some realization at some level of the Four Noble Truths. So the next part of the question is, what are its three stages?
There's small, middle, and great, and they have the more analogies of how the bodhicitta actually is in their minds. So on the small level, even though they have spontaneous bodhicitta, it can still degenerate due to any moments of anger or wrong views. So it's still kind of fragile and vulnerable. And then in the second one, the spontaneous bodhicitta is, and then the progressing along to the path of preparation is still quite a ways away. And then the second one, which is the middling path, they have the bodhicitta, they're on their way to the path of preparation, but it's slow going. And the analogy is sort of like gold, where it's very, very beautiful, doesn't decay, doesn't lose its nature, but it stays underground for ages. And so there's this kind of analogy of slow going, it's heaviness, but it's stable. And then the third one, the great one, is like the waxing moon. And here the bodhicitta is very strong. The path of preparation is very, very close. And the good qualities of a person on a greater level, the path of accumulation, are really starting to grow. They can go before the Buddhas by way of emanation. They can remember all the teachings that they've ever heard, and statues can actually teach them. So there's a lot of causes and conditions that are starting to ripen to where they will soon go on to the path of preparation.
So I'm going to repeat what Venerable Senkei has said, because I don't think the people on the telephone line can hear it. Is that true? Okay, so that was bang on, Venerable Senkei. So right, the differences between these three levels, the three stages, small, middling, and great, are exemplified through these three occasions of a sick person. So on the small path, a person has taken the medicine, but the outcome is not yet certain. So what this analogy is referring to is that one has obtained the precious mind of conventional bodhicitta, but it is not yet definite whether it will degenerate or not. So the bodhisattva has to be very careful, because it's still possible to give up bodhicitta. And then Venerable Chodron was also making the comment that if we give up our bodhicitta, we'll spend a long time in a horrible rebirth, because of the negative karma that is created from giving up bodhicitta. And the way she explained it went something like this. When we take the bodhisattva vow, you invite all sentient beings to a feast of generating your bodhicitta vow. So if one goes on to give up bodhicitta, it's like you've invited all these people to a huge feast, and then you don't serve them any food. So that's really not cool. On the small path, one has obtained the precious mind of conventional bodhicitta. However, we don't know if a bodhisattva will attain Buddhahood or not at this point, because their bodhicitta could degenerate. So the bodhisattva at this level needs to keep meditating a lot on bodhicitta so that their bodhicitta doesn't degenerate, and they need to keep meditating on emptiness. So then the middling path. Bodhicitta won't degenerate. But the bodhisattva won't go quickly to the path of preparation, so they need more merit. They need to continue to meditate on bodhicitta, which is very interesting. When they entered the path of accumulation, it has become spontaneous, but they keep practicing this. They need to keep it growing and growing. And they still need to understand emptiness better. And so this is like the sick person who is going to get well, but not necessarily very quickly. So the solution is the person at this point on the middling path keeps meditating on bodhicitta and emptiness. Then the great path, one's good qualities increase quite considerably, and one moves to the path of preparation quickly. And this is very much like the sick person is going to recover quickly. Then the next part of this question asks, what are the distinguishing features of these three stages? So would someone else like to take a shot at this one? And this is referring to the three bodhicittas. Okay, well, I'll just continue then. Anyone want to shout out anything?
Is that the analogy of the earth and the gold and the white
seed? Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of got those confused. I did the gold one already.
That's okay.
The first one, the small path of accumulation, the mind becomes like the earth, the basis for all good qualities. So that is just as the earth is the basis for all plantings and crops for life, so this mind is the basis for all the good qualities of the Mahayana path. Yet it's not definite that the earth will provide enough nourishment, and there's no certainty that they will not fail. So that's where the vulnerability of the mind, the bodhisattva, on the small path of accumulation. So it's the analogy, the feature is like the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is about the gold, that it, even though it does not decay, it's stable, it doesn't lose its nature, it can stay underground for ages, one is not able to move to the path of this analogy, the analogous to slow going, even though it's much more stable. Like gold shining and beautiful and stable, but heavy and slow going. And then the third one is like the waxing moon. So it just grows brighter and brighter and brighter. And that's where listening, keeping precepts, listening to instructions, all different kinds of teachings, and then these capacities to be able to emanate and to increase the knowledge by way of meditative stabilization, the virtues increasing like the waxing moon, their conceptual understanding of emptiness is increasing like the waxing moon, everything's getting bigger.
Mm-hmm. Great. So again, for the people who are listening on the phone, I'll just sort of summarize what you said. So earth-like bodhicitta, just as the earth is the basis for planting and growing crops, this bodhicitta is the basis for all virtuous causes of Buddhahood. All nourishment arises in dependence upon the earth. In the same way that the earth is the ground upon which everything grows, the bodhisattva on this path has generated bodhicitta, so all the good qualities that are going to come are generated on the basis of this bodhicitta. Then on the middling path, it's called the gold-like bodhicitta. And just like gold, although gold is placed underground, it can stay there for a long, long time and not decay or turn into something else. This kind of bodhicitta is stable. It's not like the bodhicitta of the small path that can degenerate. This bodhicitta never loses its character of benefiting others until the practitioner attains enlightenment by means of practicing the six far-reaching practices. And then the waxing moon bodhicitta, which is found on the great path, one's good qualities increase higher, like the daily increase of the waxing moon due to hearing advice or instructions, and by having gone by magical emanation before the Buddhas of the Ten Directions in dependence upon the meditative stabilization of the stream of doctrine. So what this means is this enables bodhisattva to have these emanation bodies that go to different pure lands, in different places, different universes, where there are Buddha's teachings. And as Venerable Chodron was saying, when you have this kind of samadhi, which is very powerful, you can receive teachings from statues, you can remember all the Dharma teachings you've ever heard, and then your good qualities are really going to grow very, very quickly. So this is why it's called the bodhicitta, the waxing moon. This progress, especially the accumulation of merit through generating bodhicitta, is really visible. So this bodhicitta, like the waxing moon, is found on the great path of accumulation. Just as the moon becomes brighter and eliminates darkness, this bodhicitta helps to continuously increase virtuous qualities and knowledges, such as the 37 harmonies with enlightenment. So the four establishments of mindfulness and all the other harmonies of enlightenment go very well. So I think this is quite incredible. I mean, to be able to produce emanation body. This is just the path of accumulation, producing emanation bodies, going to any place that you want to hear teachings, having statues talk to you. This is just really incredible. And then remembering every single Dharma teaching that you've ever heard. This is just extraordinary. So here's another little bit of the quiz. How many bodhicittas are there? These are the first three of how many? Yeah. And they're mentioned in which text? By which person? Yes, Maitreya. And what is the name? Yes, the clear moment of realization. So the last part of the question kind of goes over what we just mentioned. And Venerable Chodron says, what are the major activities that a bodhisattva does on the path of accumulation in terms of accumulating merit? So does anyone want to take a shot at summarizing what we just heard? They do a lot of meditating on which two topics? Bodhicitta and emptiness, right? And do they just stop by the time they hit the middling path and just say, that's it, I'm good? No, they keep going. They keep practicing. And then when they're on the middling path, they're turning their attention to practicing on the six far-reaching practices. And then by the time that they get to the great path, this is when the huge, huge amounts of merit start happening through, you know, all of the things we just mentioned, having these incredible abilities to produce emanations and hear statues teach and remember all these teachings. So it's quite an incredible accomplishment, really. So that is question five. Question six reads like this. How does a bodhisattva meditate in order to generate the union of serenity and insight? So when I first looked at the question, I thought, can't remember any of this. So I had to go way back in my notes and start rereading things. And as I was rereading and listening to Venerable's teachings, I was still having a huge problem sort of putting it together. So because I am a visual learner, I decided that I would lay it out in the form of a chart. So in a moment, I'm going to move over to the chart. And it has helped me sort of deal with all of these pieces, and perhaps it will help you. Another thing that very much helped my re-understanding of the material is in Guy Newland's book called Introduction to Emptiness. He has one chapter on insight that is absolutely so brilliant and so clear that this was another resource that I used in figuring out the progression of how a bodhisattva progresses on the path. So, Guy Newland starts off by saying this about a bodhisattva at the beginning stages of the path of accumulation. The initial realization of emptiness is a profound certainty arrived at through analytical meditation. While it is very powerful, it is conceptual and therefore dualistic. So the question arises, of course, how does a bodhisattva go from a conceptual dualistic understanding of emptiness to a non-conceptual, non-dualistic experience of emptiness? So we're going to explore part of that journey tonight. We're not going to go the whole way to non-dualistic and non-conceptual because that goes beyond, way beyond the path of accumulation. But we're going to go as far as the bodhisattva attaining the union of serenity and insight. So then Guy Newland goes on to explain that to refine a conceptual and dualistic understanding of emptiness into a liberating non-dualistic experience, the bodhisattva uses the power of serenity developed through stabilizing meditation. So I'm going to go over to the chart now, and we're going to start off by talking about what stabilizing meditation is. So the way this chart is laid out, we're going to go from the bottom up. And so here we are with the first step that a bodhisattva is doing, the stabilizing meditation. And this is the practice of engaging mindfulness and vigilance. Mindfulness keeps our attention on the object, and vigilance is watching carefully to see when the attention slips. So, this then allows one to focus the mind and maintain attention continuously and clearly without distraction. So eventually, with practice, of course, the mind stabilizes and rests naturally where you have set it. Now, how does that happen? That just doesn't happen by sitting down on a cushion and just holding your breath and going for it. What Venerable Children draws to our attention is that the bodhisattva has to engage the four engagements in order for the mind to stabilize. So, pop quiz, what are the four engagements? Right. The first one is the one I'm most familiar with, forcibly keeping your mind on the object. Actually, that's the only one I know. And then the second one is called interruptedly. So your mind is there, and then it gets interrupted. I've had maybe one moment of that taste ever, because I'm still working on the forcibly. Then the third one is uninterruptedly. So you can stay on the object pretty consistently. And then the fourth one is just beautiful. It's called spontaneous, where you just turn your mind to the object and it stays there. I can't wait for that to happen. So, the four engagements are what the bodhisattva uses to arrive at this place where the mind stabilizes. Then, over a long period of time, I don't know what periods of time happen between these steps. I'm sure it's quite individual. But over a long period of time, when the practice develops to the point that your body and mind are pliant and blissful, at this point, one has attained serenity. And Guy Newland has a very lovely definition of serenity. He describes it like this. It's a state in which the mind and body have become pliant as the mind focuses firmly and one-pointedly upon its object. One-pointed absorption on a single object of concentration weakens the ordinary dualistic sense of subject and object. Pliancy means that your mind and body are serviceable and responsive. There's no resistance to practice. You take delight in focusing your mind on a virtuous object while your body feels light and buoyant. Okay, it can happen any time. So that's where we are here with serenity. The mind and body are pliant and blissful. And it seems like just an incredible thing to achieve. I mean, it is an incredible thing to achieve. So Guy Newland goes on by explaining this further. He says that bodhisattvas definitely must learn to focus their mind in this way. This is what creates the mental power that allows them to progress from discursive analysis of reality to direct non-dualistic realization. Now, he also says, at this point of achieving serenity, a bodhisattva could have used any object. Venerable Children often, you know, mentions the image of the Buddha. But this is going to change at this point. And I also want to come over here to this point. So this point isn't happening simultaneously with developing serenity. But I put this here because things don't go forward without this part happening. And this is that the bodhisattva has separately realized emptiness through analysis. So Venerable Children has pointed out that a person can realize emptiness conceptually even before going on the path of accumulation. But for this to continue, this has happened at some point in time. I'm not sure when. Okay. So having attained serenity using image of the Buddha or another object and having separately realized emptiness through analysis, the bodhisattva then learns to make emptiness itself the conclusion established in analysis as the object of serene attention. So we need to remember that serenity focused on emptiness is itself still a conceptual mind. And this is because emptiness, having been realized through inferential analysis, presents itself to the bodhisattva's mind as a conceptual image. It is this image, this idea of emptiness, that is then taken as a meditative focal point for serenity. So now the object that is the focus of the serenity meditation is emptiness. This image, this idea. Okay, I'm going to go over to the flip chart for a moment. These points really caught my attention as I was reading them. I think this is a good time to mention them. And so Guy Newland has pointed out these three, and he's drawing on Tsongkhapa's teachings. So the first point is, one may attain serenity without yet having realized emptiness. So that's one possibility. Then one may also analyze and even realize emptiness first and then set out to attain serenity. But here's the big but at this point. So one must not do extensive analytical meditation while working to achieve serenity for the first time. So any ideas why you wouldn't want to do that? Why would this be something that you don't want to do while you're working to build up this power of serenity?
Causes the mind to vibrate.
Right. So too much analysis disturbs the concentration, and you're not going to get there. You're not going to make it to serenity. Okay, I'm going to come back to this chart for a few minutes. So once serenity has been attained, one must return to analytical meditation, working again and again through reasonings demonstrating that things are empty of intrinsic nature. So the bodhisattva has to sustain the understanding of emptiness by repeatedly returning to analysis using multiple lines of reasoning. In this way, one becomes deeply accustomed to the knowledge that things are empty. Tsongkhapa says that ascertainment of the view becomes strong, long-lasting, clear, and steady to the extent that one becomes accustomed to what one has determined. So this continues, this return to analysis using multiple lines of reasoning. And then at this point, now the bodhisattva is using the four engagements on emptiness, so forcibly, interruptedly, uninterruptedly, and then spontaneous. And again, I can't imagine what it would be like to stay on the object of emptiness and just have your attention stay there without interruption.
This is still all conceptual, simple.
Yes.
We're still on the path of...
Yes, this is still conceptual. All right. So Bhava Viveka explains that after your mind is set in equipoise, this is how wisdom investigates. This doesn't mean that there is no analysis before attaining serenity, but there is this emphasis, and this emphasizes the importance of continuing analysis after serenity is achieved. And then Guy Newland then goes on to talk about the fact that there has to be this alternating. So in addition, it will not work to do only analytical meditation after serenity. Just as the force of the bodhisattva's certainty about emptiness will weaken if it's not sustained by repeated analysis, so too the strength of the bodhisattva's serenity will weaken if it's not refreshed with repeated practice of stabilizing practice. So at this point now, the bodhisattva is alternating between stabilizing and analytical meditation. And then to speak about this balance that the bodhisattva is trying to achieve at this point, Kamala Shila explains it in another way, which is very nice. It makes it very clear. And he says that too much analysis will weaken one's serenity like a flame placed in the wind. It wavers, becoming unfocused so that it doesn't see reality clearly. Then again, too much serenity on emptiness without refreshing one's certainty about emptiness with analysis results in an inability to see reality clearly, like a person who is asleep. So the mind is strong, but the clarity of the object, emptiness, is weakening due to not being more refreshed, due to not being refreshed with more analysis. And then Venerable Children also makes the point here that she reminds us that while a bodhisattva is alternating between stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation, the conceptual part is very subtle. This is not coarse discussion now going on in our mind. It's very subtle, and the person is investigating questions like, who am I? What does the word I really refer to? What is there that is me? So this goes on again for quite some time. And then, of course, you know, how does a bodhisattva know what to do along the way? Well, as Venerable Children again reminds us, all of these endless causes and conditions had to be created. And specifically, one has to be relying on a spiritual mentor. And, of course, one has by this time listened to a lot of teachings and contemplated the meanings of the teachings, and specifically the teachings on concentration and emptiness. But, of course, the critical factor here is relying on a spiritual mentor. So, that takes us to this point. So, after long practice, the bodhisattva's analytical wisdom itself spontaneously induces the blissful and pliant condition of serenity. So now Guy Newland gives us some more explanation for this point. The term insight refers to analytical wisdom that in the same session of meditation and without interruption or effort brings about serenity focused upon the object one is analyzing. When profound analytical insight naturally gives rise to serenity, this is then called the union of serenity and insight. And what does this mean? Guy Newland's explanation of this point is that it's the fusion of analytical power and sublime one-pointed focus. It is a mind that powerfully and analytically discerns its object without any way fluctuating from pliant and one-pointed absorption. Analytical wisdom is true insight when within that very session of meditation, analysis induces and becomes fused with serenity. So I'm going to go back over to the flip chart for a moment. And I think this is a good time to make these two points, these two observations by Lama Tsongkhapa. So Lama Tsongkhapa says you cannot develop true insight simply by realizing emptiness once in analysis and thereafter practicing only serenity meditation in which you stabilize your mind on that conclusion. In addition, insight is impossible if emptiness is something that you analyzed one time and then only remembered having realized. So Venerable Children goes on to explain that this mind of insight, which is a wisdom mind, is a powerful antidote to the afflictions at this point. So instead of stabilizing and analytical meditations contradicting each other, as they would have earlier, at this point they complement each other, and they make the mind more and more powerful to counteract the afflictions. This mind apprehends the exact opposite of what ignorance apprehends. It has the ability to eliminate the ignorance. It has the serenity to back it up so that when you are analyzing, your mind is not all over the place. When you reach a conclusion, you can stay on that conclusion and have it really permeate the mind. This is why the union of serenity and insight is important. So, those are the steps. And, you know, before hearing these teachings, I only had this sort of vague sense that a person would just, you know, hear about stabilizing meditation and just, you know, stick with it until something happened. And that's not the case at all. And even though these are steps that for me are millions of lifetimes away, it really looks possible. It really looks like, you know, it makes sense. It's doable. It's like the path isn't just for people who are already enlightened. It's for people who are not enlightened and they can progress in this way. So His Holiness has a quote that I thought would be very nice to finish with, and if anyone has any comments, these are the points I have for tonight. So he says this: our mind as it is now is completely scattered to external objects due to which it is powerless. Our thought is like water running in every direction. But just as water, when channeled, becomes powerful, so it is with our minds. So this gives me great hope. And that we, you know, in our case, everyone who has the chance to hear His Holiness teach and to hear Venerable Chödrön teach, we have this opportunity to develop our minds to this incredible state. And the union of serenity and insight, remember, is just at the end of the path of accumulation. There's four more paths to go. So this is quite an astounding thing to contemplate. It really is inspiring for my mind. So does anyone have anything that I missed, or you'd like to make additional comments?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can I get number 7, the four engagements? I think you asked this, but I guess I don't get it. When you do the four engagements on emptiness, are you doing a serenity meditation then, or are you doing an analytical? I think you said you're doing an analytical meditation then.
Well, when I was looking at that, and I don't know that I'm right, so we'll have to ask our teacher, but I thought it was serenity meditation on emptiness.
Right, that's what makes more sense to me. But I think when I wrote it down,
But I'm not sure.
But that doesn't make sense to me now that I think about it.
Because the four engagements refer to different levels of
serenity. So it must be that you're... Yeah, I'm thinking it is serenity too. Does anyone else?
Because it follows number 6, which is repeatedly returning to analysis using multiple lines of reasoning. Somewhere along the line, the analysis becomes so subtle and so probing that then the four engagements maybe can be utilized to kind of...
Yeah, I remember when she taught it, I was thinking that she was referring to analytical meditation and her mind kind of went...
You know, I think I'm remembering now something that she did say, because I think that, yeah, okay, I'm glad you asked this. Yes, and I think what I just said is incorrect. Mm-hmm. I think at this point now, it is the four engagements, but using analytical meditation. Because she said, first you do it with stabilizing, mm-hmm. then you do it with analytical meditation. So yeah, thanks for making that clear.
It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
So there's a coarse form of analytical meditation on emptiness, an interrupted level, an uninterrupted level, and a spontaneous level of analysis also.
I think that's what we've concluded just now. If anyone online has another understanding, maybe you can type in to Venerable Jigme, who's watching the screen.
Well, I find that that for so many years, Venerable wanted us very much, and still does want us to understand what the purpose and the importance of analytical meditation. So when she first gave us, offered the concentration retreat 2 falls ago. When I think about all the years that she has given us long rim retreats and really gotten us to understand and use our minds to reflect and integrate the Dharma to practice and ask these very open-ended questions, then after, you know, for many of us, many years, then really focusing on then how do we use the mind to concentrate on an object. You know, she never had a concentration retreat until 2 years ago. So I found that maybe there is just this, I don't know, the need to use our minds in a correct way before we can then focus it on the object itself.
Mm-hmm.
I just found it really, that she didn't get into concentration early on when she started teaching at the Abbey. It was always a conclusion that we came to with under analysis, but it wasn't as focused as she's starting to now make it very alternating and seeing how they go together. I just found that, I just noticed when she offered that for the first time, 2 falls ago, I said, wow, concentration. Yeah. Maybe she thinks we're ready.
I think that's by design, then, too. Because in the Galupa tradition, they don't want people to just... Well, they always give all these warnings about... They say you need to have serenity first, but then they focus on the other because they don't want you to just go the path of serenity and, you know, become an arhat.
Or get blissed out and experience and then not use analysis to really do what it can do for me.
I'm puzzled by, of course, a lot of it, but this number 10, that the analytical wisdom induces the serenity, it goes against this idea that on the other side of the chart, that if you early on do too much analysis, you disturb your serenity. So something has completely changed in this, in all these steps. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm pretty fascinated by. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts about it, but you see it's changed from, oh, analysis will disturb your calm abiding in the early ways right. our minds are functioning, and now it's actually inducing it. But I suppose it's because the object you're analyzing is now emptiness itself. Is that part of it? What your analytical wisdom is focused on the nature of emptiness. Is that right?
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a different object than what we're focused on early on when we're analyzing things. No,
it's funny that you think of that in terms of the object, because I was thinking of it in terms of the subject. And what I was thinking is
they're
like probing awareness, you know, their analysis is getting just maybe more and more refined and subtle and less what would be the word?
Discursive.
This less discursive, I guess would be the word. I want to say conceptual, but that's not right.
So both of those things must be going on deeper and deeper awareness, and then the object is getting more and more subtle.
We're guessing, but
it brings about.
Done?
I don't know something on this part.
Well, I'll just reread what I read earlier, which at this point for me is mystical, but after long practice, the bodhisattva's analytical wisdom itself spontaneously induces the blissful and pliant condition of serenity. So this analytical wisdom that in the same session of meditation and without interruption or effort brings about serenity focused upon the object one is analyzing. So it's...
When we say exalted wisdom, that's a mind, not a process.
Well, I'm not sure.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the wisdom mind is inducing the serenity, not the analysis that this mind is doing. It's the mind, the awareness itself.
It's when you're doing analytical meditation, which then induces the serenity. So, I mean, it's your mind, but what is actually inducing the serenity is the analytical meditation. That's how I understand
it. Because it doesn't say analytical meditation induces serenity, it says analytical wisdom. There's something about the wisdom being different than the way it's said before.
Isn't it though, like, when you analyze an object, then you have it more, as you said, in a more conceptual way, and then it's switching over that there's no subject and object anymore, so your mind is the same substance like the object, you know? It's, how you say, like the Buddha nature, it's pure awareness, but it's one element, it's empty of inherent existence, and then your mind... It's not your mind anymore. There's no real meditator, and I don't know.
I don't think that happens at this point. I think that happens like at the path of seeing. This is still the path of accumulation. Yeah.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have this name, analytical wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we said the wisdom realizing emptiness. That's what I'm thinking, is the wisdom in inducing serenity. There's something about the wisdom used in this way.
Yeah.
What is this wisdom?
Right. Well, that's all I have for tonight.
I have a question.
Oh, yes.
Changes, you mean like, say if you were doing the object on the breath, and then you get that nimitta?
Yeah, then so, then yeah. An object appears in front of you.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, right. What they're referring to here is that you might have been using the breath, which even though it changes into something, this nimitta, still you call that the breath, and then, or you might have been using the Buddha, or any of the many objects that the Buddha described. But then now you have to use emptiness. And I often say that emptiness isn't a very easy object to develop serenity on because we don't know what the object is.
Mm-hmm.
I might as well pick something a little easier. Because I've talked to Venerable extensively about using the mind as the object, and that's exactly what they say about that one. They say it's hard when you try to just do that conventional nature of mind and look at the mind. I mean, it's a lot easier to pick the breath because it's a physical sensation that you can put your attention on.
Yeah, Geshe Rabin said once it's like having like an odd person using a stock for walking but without the stock. So,
but I don't think I quite answered your question.
Yeah, shamatha, maybe it's on path four, I can't remember.
You mean the nine steps?
Yeah.
Those, I think, are in here would be kind of like two and three.
Yeah.
Would include, one through three would include the nine stages that lead to calm guiding.
Awesome.
I believe.
So then it makes sense. But
Continuously placing, mm-hmm. continuously placing.
Because mm-hmm. you start out not very stable.
Yeah, just placing.
Very first one.
Yeah.
So more questions have come out of this, which is good. We can keep reflecting on it. So thank you everyone for joining us tonight.